Heather Krutik is a relationship, nervous system, and feminine embodiment coach who guides intelligent, successful women and men to reestablish trust, connection, and intimacy in long-term relationships they're not ready to give up on. Twice married and twice divorced by 40, she brings a rare, lived understanding of how old patterns, unhealed wounds, and limiting beliefs quietly shape the emotional climate of a partnership. 6 years after separating and divorcing her second husband, father of her son, Bella and her ex-husband reconciled and co-created the deeply honest, connected, and passionate relationship they once believed was impossible. Drawing on body-led, feminine embodiment work and nervous system awareness, she now has clients move from flatlining, flatmate dynamics, into relationships that feel fully alive, grounded in self-responsibility, and open to pleasure and possibility. There's a lot there. It feels like you've gone out, right, I'm going to go and live this, then I'll explain it to people. So you've done the hard yards yourself. Thank you, all of us, for that. And thank you for joining us. It's very kind of you to spend the time.
I'm absolutely glad. Thank you for having me.
I just wanted to start by taking you back a little bit, if that was okay, just to your formative years, just to get a glimpse of he was a teenager. Would the 14-year-old Bella recognize he was today?
Oh, she was a different person. The 14-year-old me was a model student, a real people pleaser. She followed the rules. She did all the right things. You know, if I bring it back to the first person, I was classic girl. That's how I was raised. And at 18, I was still very much that person. I did all my studies. I did all the extracurricular activities. I played classical piano. Like, I really ticked all the boxes from that perspective. And the approval of my parents and my teacher was absolutely paramount. It made me feel validated. It made me feel seen. And so I did everything that I thought would get me that validation and approval. The well done, you've done the right thing kind of feedback from everybody. And that at 14, I was certainly that person. A couple of years later, things changed. Around 17, as nearing the end of high school, I certainly became more rebellious, testing boundaries, that sort of thing. And so I think the 14-year-old version of me would recognize parts of herself in him today, in that she was vulnerable, she was open, she loved to share. So I am still like that, or I have become like that once again, rather. But she probably wouldn't recognize the version of me that took a different path, that didn't necessarily follow the path that my parents and society had laid out for me. I realized in my early 20s or mid-20s, I don't think that life is for me. So I don't think 14-year-old recognizes that part of me now.
And I know you talked about being a first-generation Australian, and the family culture was playing small and staying safe. Is your family originally from Latvia?
Yes, that's exactly right.
I've been to Riga, which is very beautiful.
It is.
Very, very, very cold. I was always talking about the weather. And we're walking across the bridge that goes over the water, and I'm like, God, absolutely feeling I was going to freeze. But it's a beautiful country. And do you think part of the people pleasing and fitting in was part of that culture that people bring to a country when they first move there?
I think it was part of the culture, absolutely. I think that was how my parents were raised, and so that is what they knew best. But there was also an element of the fact that they had taken this big risk at quite a young age to move to a completely unfamiliar country. And in a way, they wanted to hold that risk, and they didn't want me to take any more risks. So playing safe, playing small, following that path that, you know, others before me and had proven to be good enough was the path that they wanted me to take, because they want me to make mistakes. I remember they used to say to me, learn from our mistakes, don't make the same mistakes we did. Whereas my view was, the only way you're really going to learn is if you make the mistake. So I think there was an element of the culture they were raised in. So the fact that they were immigrants and had taken so many risks already, jumped completely into the unknown. Yeah.
It's always hard as a parent of, an 18-year-old and a 16-year-old now, I think we're almost programmed to want our children to learn from our mistakes. But when you actually look at it in reality and learning it now, certainly with my daughter being away at university, I don't know what I can learn is learn from their mistakes. I can read a book about mistakes, but it doesn't stop me making them myself, because the mistakes they're going to make, the mistakes you made, the mistakes I made, they're different, aren't they? We've got to own our own mistakes and then try and learn from those. You can't just absorb what somebody else does wrong, in inverted commas, and then say, right, I'll back away from that. There's some obvious things you want to avoid, like terrible things, like painful things, but in general, the mistakes we make in love, in life, in relationships, they're our own to own and to hold, I think.
Yeah, exactly. You can't really embody or learn those lessons just by being told. It's not enough for someone to tell you and for you to maybe intellectually understand it on some level. You really have to experience that and feel that pain to be able to learn, okay, what am I going to do differently next time? And actually, I think I equate embodiment very often to touching a hot stove. You can be told not to touch the hot stove, and you can spend years as a young child staying away from it. But until you actually touch it, not that I'm anybody to do that, but until you actually feel that pain in your body, until you know what that sensation is, it's only then that you truly know, not just in your head, but in your body. So there's that mind-body understanding. And from you know, okay, I'm never going to touch that hot stove again. So that's a true learning. That's a true lesson.
So when you sort of hit 17, 18 and you were leaving high school and you were going on to the next step of your life, is that when you became more, I'm sure confidence is the right word, but more aware of yourself, more confident? That's when you start to explore relationships. And how self-aware were you at the time of sort of 17, 18?
Completely unaware. So unaware. Just doing things that I saw modeled before me, seeing the way other people did relationships, whether they were my friends, parents, or their friends. Sense of what I wanted, but it was very much planted in my mind. You know, you go to university, you get a sensible, you meet a young man who shares the families, you get married and you settle down. And that was very much what I was looking for in those early years. Well, it wasn't perfect, because I had relationships where I wasn't thinking about, okay, what do I want? What am I really looking for? Well, I want to grow and expand and stretch myself. I was very, very much of do what they want, be a people pleaser, you know, be chill in inverted commas, don't ask for too much. Very much playing in that girl people pleasing lane, and ended me in a marriage at the age of 20 with a man who ticked all the boxes, and my family loved him. You know, he was fantastic, but enough. But ultimately, that marriage disintegrated 4 years later. And it was because I didn't see the warning signs, but I also wasn't advocating for myself in that relationship. I was doing, again, what I had seen modeled before me. I was doing all the things that I believed was right, but I was so unfulfilled. I was settling. I was self-abandoning without even realizing it. I was angry and resentful, but I understand why. Because I thought, I'm doing it right. Why am I so unhappy? Why am I so resentful? Why doesn't he me? So in terms of, was I self-aware at 17, 18? I would say no. But I became more so as I spent more and more time in that marriage.
So when you came out of the first marriage at quite a young age, obviously came out of that thinking, okay, this didn't work. need to change things. This is uncomfortable. It's not what I wanted. And then you went into another marriage. But then that marriage didn't work at the time either. So did there is some good news to come, listeners. Don't worry. You just get happier. But do you think so? Had you not done enough work on yourself before the second marriage, or were the reasons different as to why that didn't work at the time?
Well, I definitely had not done enough work on myself. The reason I can say that with confidence is because I repeated the same errors in the second marriage. Things like blaming him for everything, not advocating for myself, not holding boundaries, self-abandonment, all of things I repeat again. After the first marriage, I believed it's not me. I'm actually a great partner because I show up in all the ways they need me to. It was obviously him. I took no responsibility. I did no work. I simply thought I will find someone else who will tick all of my boxes, not my family's boxes, society's boxes. I'm going to find someone who I think is wonderful, and then we're never going to have any problems. Obviously, that is not true. That is not how it worked out. And I love to talk about this idea. So many people have, mostly subconsciously, that about this ideal partner that exists somewhere out there. We know intellectually that humans aren't perfect, that no one is perfect, but we still do have this tendency to hold on to this ideal that one day this person who never triggers me, who hits me, who shows up in all the ways I need them to, when really the only person who needs to show up in all the ways is ourselves. So the work is very much on us. But to answer your question, I did not do that in between marriages. And in between, you know, there was a sort of close to a year after the separation when I met my next partner. And it all happened very, very quickly. It was very exciting, very much in love, very passionate, and fiery as well, but no work in between.
But happily, that's the happy part. So 6 years after, I think it was 6 years after separation, 3 years after divorce, you and your second husband got back together again. And are now happily together with family, and it's all working wonderfully, I seem. So what changed?
So in the relationship, then our marriage, we didn't have the ability to deal with our constantly arising issues. We were unaware that we were bringing our own unhealed trauma, our own unhelpful patterns into that relationship. We bred a lot and would blame one another. You know, he wanted too much affection, I was cold. He wasn't listening, I was detached. You know, I was over-functioning and he was disconnected. I mean, there's a lot of things that changed, but for me, I never thought we would get back together. That was completely out of my mind, not even a possibility. So what actually changed was a result of all of the self-inquiry and the inner work and the self-reflection that I did. Now, I started to become a feminine embodiment coach. I was required to practice all of the various modalities, and there was so much inner reflection. There was so much going into the body to explore what I hadn't even known was there for so many years. Things like living my life according to somebody else's rules, not setting any boundaries in my relationships. I didn't even know that you could hold a boundary in a relationship. But that's because my understanding of a boundary was a hard no to something, which of course is not what it is. But I learned that there were ways that you could show up in a relationship where you owned your part and it didn't have to mean that you were weak as a result or that there was something wrong with you. I learned that you could be vulnerable, open, you could be present, you could hold their hurt and pain as well, without it meaning anything wrong, that they were wrong, that you were wrong. And so these were all things that contributed to our ability to reconcile before we actually, you know, just, hey, let's get back together. So there were many steps that had to happen and many things that I had to realize about myself and how I was showing up before I could even consider it a possibility.
Do you think part of the reason for that, in terms of how we perhaps view what a relationship should look like and what our different roles should be and that we should have everything, do you think part of that is to do with how society's guided us? Because we hear the words, you can have it all and a perfect relationship and all of these things. Do you think part of it is that it's almost... we look at the media and we read and we hear and we listen and we think, gosh, I should be having it all. Everything should be perfect. There shouldn't be any issues. There should be no boundaries. I shouldn't be vulnerable because why would I? Do you think part of the problem is how society's almost programmed us?
Without a doubt. I mean, when you think about romance, when you think about romantic novels, all those dragon books and vampire books and all the things that, you know, in the last 10 years have become so popular. We read that and we think, well, surely that person must have experienced something like that in order to be able to write it. So therefore that must exist. Therefore that perfect situation, that perfect person, that perfect relationship must exist. All I have to do is find the right person. I definitely think he has put us in an unfair position almost. This unrealistic expectation that people strive for, and it removes self-responsibility. It puts all the responsibility on this version of person that we've created in our minds. And so you show up in a relationship and everything is wonderful at first, and then, you know, the cracks start to show, the humanness, the humanity starts to reveal itself and people think, oh my God, red flag. It's, some things are red flags, but most things are just being human, knowing who they really are, not having the energy or capacity to keep pretending to be this perfect person. And, you know, ultimately we need to give people permission to be human, to show up as all of themselves, because that is the person you fall in love with, not this perfect mask-wearing version of a human. And if we give them grace and space to be themselves, we're also giving ourselves permission to be able to do that and to show all of ourselves. And that is where love and connection truly grows.
That was a great answer. And I think when we go into a relationship, we sort of forget that relationships don't exist in a bubble, that life and work and family and children and money and millions of other things have an impact. If we literally just lived in a bubble with our partner, things may well be different, but life does get in the way. So when you moved into embodiment and healing, so your path is very much body led through embodiment rather than necessarily through analysis. So for someone that does live in their head, if that makes sense, what does, and maybe it's an unfair question, but what does feminine embodiment actually mean in practice?
I like that question, because it's not, you know, while the term is being used more and more, I think it's a bit of a vague abstract concept. So thank you for asking me that. much understand what you mean about living in your head. I would say the majority of people spend a day of their lives living in their neck up, if that's. I ask your listeners to consider, what did you do today? When's the last time you checked into your body? Have you even thought what your body feels like? Have you even, at the office, for example, have you felt your body in your seat? Most people will say no. We are so busy rushing around. Planning, going over the past, you know, not being present. So yes, we do it all the time. Feminine embodiment is a practice that encourages you to move down from your head and into your body. What does that actually mean? It means becoming more aware of what is called your inner felt senses. So me as a feminine embodiment coach would guide you through the different parts of your body. What is your throat like? What does your heart space feel like? What does your belly feel like? And so on. In to teach, become more aware of what is happening in your body. Why do we do this? When you're in your body, you are present. You are in tune with the wisdom of your body. And you're aware of what's called frozen tension. So these are things we have held onto for days, months, years, you know, old resentments, disappointments that we have not addressed. When you hold frozen tension in your body, you cannot be in flow. And to live your life in alignment, to understand your body's wisdom, you need to acknowledge, sit with, and then release that frozen tension so you can then be in flow. And as you practice this, as you become more practiced at being able to tune into what's happening in your body, you become more aware of your own body's wisdom. Okay, which sounds bizarre, but actually you become so good at already understanding and hearing what's happening in your body that things like making decisions become easier. Knowing what you really want become easier. Being able to identify what your boundaries, being able to express what is causing you pain right now. So in the context of a relationship, if your partner triggers you, for example, you are to be present in that moment, and instead of reacting, you can respond. That feeling of, okay, that hurt me, that upset me, and express that from a grounded place from within your body. So feminine embodiment teaches you how to hold presence in your body, how to sit with discomfort, how to express from a grounded place, rather than being in the head and reacting to things. He's just trying to hurt me. That knows that that upsets me. He knows that he should have unpacked the dishwasher. You know, what the thing is, you're not reacting to your own trauma. You're not reacting from your head. You're simply expressing me. And you can also, and it also allows you to understand where they're coming from as well. Because when they're in pain, you can hold that discomfort as well. You don't get defensive. You don't try and explain the way. You can hold their pain and discomfort and hurt as well. So it's very different to talk therapy about analysis. It's not about what happened in the past. It's about learning to be present in your body in the here and now.
Thank you. It's very interesting when you said that a lot of people live sort of neck upwards, and it's a phrase I've used before, because I went to a psychologist therapist maybe a year ago. Both my parents died relatively close together, and I was really struggling with how to grieve, really, and thought, people say, you go and talk to somebody. So I went to talk to somebody, and we spent a lot of time and a lot of money exploring my childhood and the past and everything else. And I eventually, I sort of came out of a session and thought, I can't do this anymore, because all the feelings and all the issues I've had, I could literally almost visualize them in my stomach. And there's this hard mass that I could sort of feel. And because there was no somatic element to the therapy, it just felt like all I'm ever going to get to is I'm going to fix it in my brain, but I'm still going to hold on to my body. So I really, really applaud what you're doing. I think it resonates massively that we're learning so much about how our body holds on to things, how, as the book says, our body keeps a score, all of those things. Our body has its own memory. It's distinct from the brain. So did life and the relationship just feel very different once you'd embraced this way of being?
Completely different. I love to talk about the reconciliation process first, simply because it was so necessary to get to a place where we could be together again. And then the reason it was able to happen, and the reason it was so powerful, is because I learned how to stop running from things that were hard. And this is maybe something we can talk about in a few moments, but there's a pleasure and pain principle that I learned and that I teach as part of relationship coaching. We can only hold as pleasure as we can hold pain. They are the flip side. They are the opposite side of the same coin. What I used to do was null from pain. Anything hurt or was difficult, I would try to myself from that pain. As a result of that, my ability to feel pleasure was very heavily diminished. So I learned how to sit in discomfort, how to face what was painful in honor of pleasure. So Sarah and I were reconciling and we were having these incredibly difficult, incredibly honest conversations about how much we had hurt one another. I did not run away from it. I could sit with that discomfort of being told this me and hold it and accept it. And I think that is so key to building, like to reconnecting with your partner, to build intimacy with your partner. And so I was able to bring that into our relationship again, instead of analyzing the problem and saying, yes, but you said this and you did that, and him saying the same thing back to me and us going nowhere. I was able to hold it and really listen, actually, which is so key in a relationship. And accept that as well. So that is a whole new way inside our relationship. I'm not running away. I'm not trying to rationalize what he's saying. I'm not gaslighting him and saying, that shouldn't upset you. That's not what I meant. That wasn't my intention. I can say, I'm sorry I hurt you. And that is, again, so key to building connection with someone and intimacy without, and I'll take one step back here. I learned that in reverse, I could also say the things to him that I had previously been too afraid to say for fear of, you know, how it would be taken. You know, am I going to be abandoned or rejected or whatever? I could equally say that to him and build up that sense of safety. I know now that I had evidence, I had proof that I say the hard thing, express a boundary, express pain, express disappointment, and I knew this was something we couldn't do before, and that was brought into our relationship and helped us to reconnect again.
So going back into the relationship, obviously you've done a huge amount of work on yourself and you've experienced lots of emotions going through what you've been through, and you recognize there's a different way forward. Annie, you obviously can't speak for your partner, but how did How did that sit with him then? Because in essence, and I'm not trying to dumb this down, you're sort of saying, it's okay, I've changed, I'm different. let's go again. So had he done work on himself as well?
Yes, he had. Okay. He had. I mean, one big thing that has nothing embodiment or therapy is that he actually stopped drinking, which made a huge difference to him and to us. But he also went to therapy. He went to men's circles. I think he realized that he wanted, I think it stemmed from the fact that he wanted to be a better role model for our son. And if we were ever going to get back together, you know, he had to show his son what a good partner looks like, how a good partner behaves. So I think a lot of his motivation, other than us getting back together, was our son as well. So yes, he did work, different kind of work, but work nonetheless.
So a lot of people listening will be in relationships, no matter how long in a relationship for, and it could be 2 years, could be 10 years, could be 40 years. And they'll resonate with being in the sort of flatmate mode. And by that, I mean, you're living with somebody and you're sharing with a house with somebody, but you just feel more like a friend as opposed to anything else. And and I wondered a couple of things, really. First of all, how can you perhaps recognize the signs that that's happening quickly? And then if you are listening to this, you think, oh gosh, yeah, that is, gosh, when did we last have sex? When did we last cuddle? When did we last? Whatever. If you find yourself thinking that, is it too late then, or can you pull things back?
You can definitely pull things back. The first signs, I think, of your relationship turning from lovers to flatmates is your conversations change. So your conversations change from close, connected, deep conversations to conversation about logistics. Okay, if you have kids, if you have children, you're probably talking about what activities they've got, who's taking them when, and what's for tea, or if you're in Australia, what's for dinner. And it's what your conversations become about. And then once the kids are asleep, you're either back at your laptop working, one of you's watching television, one of you's doom scrolling. You're not taking the time to prioritize deep connected conversations with your partner. You're tired, they're tired, you just switch off. Completely understandable. But these are signs that you're not making the to connect with your partner as someone more than just a flatmate or the mother or father of your child or children. That is normally the first sign. And then, of course, if intimacy starts to drop down the list of priorities, you got to ask yourself, what is differentiating my partner from me and some random person who I could be sharing this flat with? Physical intimacy is a relationship. It is what separates us from friends. And it is such a shame that it drops down the list of priorities because it is such a gift. I think a lot of people start to weaponize sex. You know, he didn't do this, I'm not going to have sex with him. It normally is that dynamic. She's normally withholding from him. It stops being seen as the beautiful, connected, sacred experience that it actually is. And there are many reasons that are complex, and there are many layers as to why this happens. But this is such a key part of how we shift from lovers to flatmates. And so bringing back that connection, bringing back those conversations even that then lead to more intimacy is so key. So key. You know, being intimate with your partner allows you both to feel loved and connected, held and seen. It's not just this physical act for, you know, a few moments of relief and pleasure. I think it's important for us to shift how we view sex. It's not something we might give or not give. It's an opportunity for us to connect with a cherished human.
And I totally agree. And I think one of the challenges that, again, society's created is that we sort of learned to view sex as performative and goal-driven and penetration, basically. In a heteronormative relationship, you know, penis and vagina, that is sex. And I think if we could replace the word sex with pleasure or intimacy and accept that holding hands with somebody, holding somebody, I don't know, looking at somebody, giving somebody a massage, whatever, they're all very deep forms of intimacy, and it doesn't have to be all about the orgasm. And I think certainly as we get older, for women, obviously go through the menopause and the particular challenges that causes. Men, as we get older, our erections aren't the same as they were when we were 20. And sometimes it's like, oh my gosh, is he or she going to want sex? I'm not sure I can or feel like it. Or I'm just going to watch one more program. I've just got to finish this on the laptop. And you avoid just what you both might want is just a cuddle. So I do think there's something around how we define and have been led to believe what sex is from a very young age. About, you know, people ask when you're a teenager, so have you had sex yet? Have you done it? And it's very, but they're talking about penetration. They're not talking about have you kissed somebody, have you held somebody, you know, have you snuggled with somebody. So I do think there is that thing about, understanding what intimacy actually is. Does that make sense?
100%. I think right on in that there's this pressure for it to look a particular way. Absolutely be that, because that is so wonderful. But there are so many steps that happen before that. And if you're feeling disconnected from someone, you're not going to want to have penetrative sex necessarily. Or you might, but worried about how it's going to go. To me, building the steps before that need to happen in order to build that connection is touch without expectation, having those connected conversations, turning the television off, putting your phone in a different room, and sitting opposite the person that you love and sharing something. Actually, you know, if I was going to give people a suggestion for what to do right, you know, today, tonight, when they get home from work, do those things I just mentioned, but actually hold hands with your partner and feel your hands in their hands. Feel their hands in yours. Be completely aware of the sensation of skin touching with no other agenda but to connect and to feel that sensation in your body. Because, you know, we might leave the house, have a quick hug, a quick peck on the lips. We might even hold hands sometimes. We do it without really feeling it. So if we take that time to connect, on to feel the sensation in your body, that's going to change the game, because you're going to truly feel connected to the other person. And then when you can take that extra step of something vulnerable or painful, anything like that, and the other person just sitting and listening and hearing it, that's going to create so much intimacy, so much more than who's taking Tony to soccer tomorrow.
Yeah, absolutely. Something that gets talked about a lot in terms of not necessarily long-term love, but just love in general, is gratitude. And mm-hmm. It's not something that I've struggled with. I think it's something I don't necessarily understand, because gratitude sounds like, oh, I'm so grateful you're still with me, or I'm grateful we've got a relationship. And I wonder what does honest gratitude look like, and what role does it play?
Well, I think gratitude is absolutely essential in any relationship, but particularly in a long-term relationship. For me, gratitude is about zooming out to begin with. So looking at the bigger picture of the relationship and the other person. And it is about identifying things about them or the relationship that you're really happy that you have, because it's very easy to do the opposite. It's very easy to find the negative points in another person, in the relationship, focus on those, and, you know, from there, downward spiral. Mm-hmm. So gratitude is a practice. It's a muscle to exercise. It is not something that necessarily comes to us naturally. And the reason for that is because our brain to protect us from getting hurt. That's why we're constantly scanning for the bad things. So to practice gratitude is all the opposite of what comes naturally to us. But when we do practice that gratitude, when we do build that muscle, when we do see the positives in the other person, in the relationship, start to appreciate it more. You begin to appreciate more what you have. And it can be something, so for example, if someone asked me what I'm grateful for in terms of my partner, if I was to zoom out, I would say, I'm grateful for his consistent love of me and our son. Okay, that's a pretty big thing. And then I would start to zoom back in down to say something like, I'm really, really grateful that he loves health and his well-being, grateful that he cares how he looks. You know, that feels good to me. That shows me that he cares about himself and about, I think, I really like that because that makes me feel valued. It's not about convincing yourself they're great. It's not about trying to avoid the realities of your relationship where it's hard. It's about looking at another human and saying, for all your warts, for all your faults, for the complexities of our relationship, still think you're brilliant. Here is what I love about you. And so you're training your brain almost to take this different pathway to see the good and without ignoring the bad, but it's both and, okay? Yes, things are hard, and he's really making an effort. I really appreciate that. That makes me feel valued. I think it's when we stop doing that that we're on a slippery slope and your brain loves going into that negative groove, that neural pathway of, oh, bad, get out. You know, it's going to be much better if you're on your own. So we have to consciously choose to practice every day for the sake of our relationship.
You don't have to answer this, but do you ever slip? Are things always perfect in your relationship?
Oh God, no! I slip definitely. I am a big human. I do sometimes slip back into, why are you upset with me? Not what I meant. You should know that's what I meant. I'm upset that you think that's what I meant. I absolutely slip back into old past. But now I recognize doing it. Mm-hmm. I slip up, our relationship is imperfect, we still butt heads, but we know when we're doing it and we can sort of pull back and go, oh, we're doing that thing we used to do. I have to be aware, be conscious every single day of how I'm showing up. And so does he. Definitely, it's not like, oh, we're all healed, it's wonderful now, it's all rainbows and unicorns. No, and that's okay. because that would be boring.
That would be... It would, yeah. And I think you've talked before about it, one of the pleasures you get is from accepting all the messy emotions that there are, and not just thinking, well, everything's going to be perfect and sunny and there's never going to be any rain, metaphorically, but it's embracing everything. We talked before a little bit about how society has got us into this thing about you can have it all and you can do this and you can do that, and how reasonable it is to actually believe that. So a lot of your clients are naturally successful, they're high functioning, they have powerful careers, they're doing incredibly well, they're, you know, CEOs, CFOs, they're whatever, they're really successful in their yep. business life.
Mm.
Can they have as successful an intimate and personal life, or does something need to give in the business life to be able to? I guess what I'm asking is that obviously a lot of us invest a lot of time, and we can do it very naturally. We spend more time on a computer, we spend more time in meetings, we travel more, all that sort of things. So we know what's going to happen to get us promoted, all that sort of thing. Within a relationship, we're not trying to get promoted. We're not trying to get, you know, long service award or whatever. We're not. We're just in the relationship. So I just wonder whether you can have a successful, dynamic career and a successful, dynamic relationship.
I love that question. I love your metaphor. And you're not trying to climb the ladder in your relationship, you're just there. I believe you can. I don't think you necessarily need to sacrifice. I do think you need to be aware that the rules that you apply in business, you don't apply those in your relationship. So people who are really successful they've got a hard exterior, typically. Mm-hmm. They're really good at negotiating to their own benefit, okay, for the benefit of themselves or the company they work for. And they're in control. So they need to bring the opposite of that to their relationships. Learning to let go of control in a relationship is so important and so helpful. You know, instead of sort of white knuckling the relationship all the time, waiting for things to be done perfectly and for your partner to show up perfectly, if we're constantly trying to control that, we're going to have a very unhappy partner. We're going to be disappointed because ultimately we're in control of nothing but ourselves. In terms of hard exterior, works very well in the business world, but at home, you need vulnerability. You need to be able to soften. You need to be able to show your true self, because it's that builds intimacy. If you can't admit when you're wrong, if you can't show when you've been hurt, there's no getting through. You've got a wall up. Works great business, not so good at home. So these are just some examples of, you know, what it takes to be successful in the corporate world that you need to leave at the door. And when you ask what you need, don't expect them to know. And also don't treat them like treat someone at work. Be vulnerable, be open, share, show when you're hurt. Because if you're not doing those things, you're just building walls that makes it really hard for your partner to break through. Intimacy, vulnerableness, this is what we need. So it's learning about how to work when you need it and your relationship how when you need it. It's totally possible to have both. It takes effort and it takes work every single day. And by work, I don't mean showing up, making dinner reservations, holidays. That's in my like that's amazing, but that is not the work. The work is how am I showing up? Where am I bringing my pain in the past and expect the other person to heal it for me? No, it's about doing that for yourself.
And I think it's about doing the things that only you can do, I guess, because flowers, holiday, booking a restaurant, I can get my PA to do that. I don't need to do that myself. I can take the credit for it, but actually, what are the things that my PA or EA can't do for the relationship? What are those things? They're the things that are valuable, is the things that somebody else can't do. And they can be, like, so it can be very, very small, can be very, very small things. It can be, as you know, maybe it's your turn to have a lie in bed tomorrow and the partner's turn to get up with the baby or whatever you think. Well, no, I'll get up tomorrow. And that just there's something tiny like that is such a, it's like, oh my God, it's like, you give me diamonds. I'm just going to get another few hours in bed when I've been up all night with a baby. Whatever. So when you're working with somebody who is having that inner monologue or dialogue about whether should I stay in this relationship, should I leave the relationship, can I change things enough to make you happy? How do you, because I guess only the person themselves can decide whether or not they can stay and be true to themselves, or whether they should leave and look for something else. How do you almost help them on that journey, on that dialogue?
First of all, I have to say I know the being in that in-between so well. I've been there twice, and there is no universal answer. You know, ultimately it comes down to the individual and their circumstances. The questions that I would lead them through would them to discern whether they're self-abandoning or whether they're self-abandoning or whether they're leaving the relationship because they should, or whether they're leaving the relationship because they think it's, and I don't want to do the work. So if it's blaming their partner for everything without doing any self-reflection, then I would take them down that path first. So I need to be sure they're not tolerating something that's not okay. That would be the first step.
Yeah.
But also I would be asking them, is there something that you're not willing to work on? Is there something about the way that you're showing up that might be contributing to this dynamic? And if you're willing to look at that and the answer is still the same, then that's the answer. You know, my work is very much about helping people who are in a relationship that feel it's flatlining. They don't leave, but they don't know what else to do. You know, they want it to feel alive, passionate, but everything they've read, all the podcasts they've listened to, all the analysis they've done on attachments, not getting them anywhere. But if, so that is a lot of the work that I do. But if they're at the point where they're thinking, should I stay or should I go? I help them to discern between, is it just too hard and I'm not willing to do the work? Or is there actually something mentally wrong that sticking around for because I think I should? You know, I want to stay because of the kids, or I'm scared what might happen if I'm on my own. You know, I'm scared to be alone. They're not reasons to stay. So it's about weaving through and understanding what is at the core, what are the core issues, and where are you responsible for some of those, and where are you willing to do that work?
He used the word that I think is probably one of the most dangerous we have is should. And it's so often we sort of say, oh, I should stay, I should. And all of those things, that's just based on all of your imperfect collection and analysis of knowledge and data you've captured over the years, the experience of your friends and your parents and your loved ones and television and rom-coms and therapy and everything. It's all this, okay, all that literally, I can imagine all this information pointing at this arrowhead, and the arrowhead is should. And that's just such it doesn't exist. There's no such thing as like, you should do whatever. It's what you choose to do. And I think, as you said, far more eloquent than I am, making a conscious decision based on deep understanding is all you can do, really. Once you've made that decision, based on the knowledge you have and the information you have to hand and all the things you think, all the knowledge that you have, it's going to be the right decision. And the good thing is, with decisions, it can be painful, but as you've proven, you can change them. Decisions aren't necessarily locked in stone forever and a day, are they? So you've been super generous with your time. I just wanted to ask two quick questions, if that's okay. I'll let you go to your evening. One of which is that obviously people aren't generally coming to you and saying, "Hi, Bella, I just wanted to spend some money with you to tell you how perfect everything is. I'm loving my life. It's wonderful. Nothing could be better." The people come to you with some challenges. I'm sure sometimes come to you with some painful trauma that's painful for you to hear, painful for you to absorb. So I just wondered, how do you nourish and protect yourself so you're not holding on to other people's angst and other people's trauma?
That's such a great question. No one's asked me that before. I think basically what you do when you coach someone, create a container. All the conversations and all of the emotions and all of the trauma and all of the sharing is inside the container. And I've basically learned how to be inside the container with the client and then step out of that container. And that is no longer what I'm doing. I'm not sure if I'm explaining it very well, but I'm able to almost, as I said, it be in a container and put it to the side. There is, of course, time needed afterwards. If something is particularly heavy, I will often do an embodiment practice afterwards to help us and move things from and through my body. And that would look like what I call a meditation. So that plus self-care, time on my own afterwards, those sorts of things, they help me to hold space for people when I'm in the container with them and then to be able to step to one side outside of it afterwards. I hope that makes sense.
Absolutely, absolutely. I was wondering, gosh, this you must hear so many things. What do you do with it? But it's only fair to the people you're working with and your family that you can not step away, but like you say, just hold it in place at the time. You're fully present for the person. You're fully with them. You're fully in their space. And then when it's time to step away, you step away. Because you holding on to it isn't helping them at all, really. And you come back to it next time or you go to the next thing. So you know, because every interaction we have leaves a tiny imprint on us, and you can't lose it altogether, but holding on to it too tightly is not good for anybody, really. And then my final question, and I guess a comment first of all. So either you are now, and I'm telling you this more than asking, you are now in a good and happy place. You're in a happy marriage, you're a fulfilled, happy mum, you've got a great career, and things are probably what you would have wanted them to be when you were 14-year-old writing an essay at school saying, "What does my life look like when I'm 40 or whatever?" And
yeah,
but the journey to get there hasn't necessarily been a straight road. And I just wondered, whether you have a vision or a view or an ambition for the next phase of your life. What does the next period of your life look like, do you think?
I would love to still be doing this 10 years from now. Do you mean in terms of my relationship or all love?
Yeah, if you're happy to share all of the above, that would be great. But your career, I mean, I don't want to get too personal, but your career obviously is the key one. But if you're happy to share your personal view as well.
Yeah. So career, more of this, but perhaps speaking in public and sharing more of my story with more people to give people height. Maybe your relationship is not how you want it to look right now, but it is possible to the relationship you want, because ultimately how a relationship looks, feels and operates is down to people who are in the relationship. Nothing really should be coming into that. So I would like more people to understand that is entirely possible and that you can make that happen. So I want to let more people know about that. So that's ultimately where I'd like to be with my career. In terms of my relationship, we're not actually married. We got divorced and now we describe each other as each other's partner. So I don't want to get married again. I don't think we need that. But, you know, we're going to be living together and behaving like what a married couple looks like. But in terms of what it will expand into, us being able to be more and more vulnerable as the years go on, being able to hold a safe space for each other to be able to do that, building a space where conflict is not a threat. We can have conflict and it doesn't spell the end. And, you know, lots of love and intimacy and sharing amazing experiences together. That is what I see. But in 10 years from now, our son will be probably out of the house and we will be in a bit of a bubble like we spoke about before. So it'll be interesting to see what that looks like, you know, as empty nesters. I look forward to it very much.
I'll message you in a couple of years and tell you what it's like, because we've only got two more years until that happens. So it's and it's scary as much as it is exciting. I know I said they were the last two questions, but I have two more now. One of which is very personal, so we can cut this out if you're not comfortable with it. And it's, do you ever get the feeling that people external to your relationship view the fact that you don't want to get remarried as bestowing some sort of temporary nature to the relationship? That they feel isn't, it doesn't matter what they feel, but they feel that, yeah, maybe you're not 100% sure and that's why you don't want to get married.
That's so interesting. I've never thought about that, because to me, it's funny, I was a marriage celebrant before and I've been married twice. So you would think that someone in that
you're in the business, you're a believer. Yes.
Yeah. You would think that someone in my, with my experience and my history, want that piece of paper. I don't. I simply don't. Not because I'm not committed, and not because I think that somehow makes it easier to walk away, which some people may feel when they hear my story. I simply do not want that. What I want is a committed relationship that is expansive. That is very important to me. Yeah. A relationship grows and improves and faces challenges. And being married is not the answer to that necessarily. The answer to that is the commitment to doing the work that I've spoken about. The commitment is to one another as people. If you are someone who needs that marriage certificate, who needs that commitment, I completely understand that. And I totally understand that. I guess it's not a guarantee, as I've experienced. So I can understand why someone might think that, but for me, it's not essential to feel that I have that commitment from him. So no, I don't need it.
No, thank you for answering that. And then I promise this is my final one. I've read a lot of books by people that say they have a story to tell, but when you finish the book, realize they haven't had a story to tell. You have a hell of a story. So is that in your future? And you talked about how do you share things more widely. And I know sometimes you think, oh, just adding another book to the market, but your story, obviously everybody's story, your story is quite different. I wonder whether you've ever considered putting it down on paper.
I thought about it, but it's also quite a daunting thought.
Yeah.
I find that writing comes to me quite naturally, but in short form. So longer form like a book, wow, that would be a big project. And I would need a lot of support to be able to do that. But I think my, like I said before, I think my story offers hope. And I think it shows through experience and through my example that it is possible to repair rupture. It is possible to reconnect and to grow from that place. Even when you've thought there is no way that that would happen. I mean, if someone asked me 3-4 years ago, would you ever get back together with your partner? I would have said there's no chance. Like, I wouldn't have even considered it. So life is funny in that way. And yeah, I think it's a, I think it's an interesting story and one that people want to hear. So if you know any good publishers, let me know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you so, so much for your time. I really appreciate you spending your
evening. It's a pleasure. Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
It was really, 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 really good. I'll let you get back to your family. But thank you again.
Thank you. All the best.